I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. The Pennsylvania courts have been in the news lately, and most of it not good. In Philadelphia, traffic court judges have been indicted. The Kids for Cash scandal involving Luzerne County judges remains a taint on the court system. Former Supreme Court Justice Joan Ori Melvin was convicted of campaign corruption. Former Supreme Court Justice Seamus McCaffrey resigned while facing an ethics probe involving pornographic emails and other allegations. Attorney General Kathleen Kane claims that the Supreme Court did not have the legal authority to investigate her for allegedly leaking confidential grand jury information to the Philadelphia Daily News. She could be charged with a number of crimes while she says she has done nothing wrong. Meanwhile, there will be elections this year to fill the three vacancies on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court and other courts as well. And just to add to the drama, the U.S. Supreme Court heard a case this week charging that the ban on judicial candidates asking for campaign contributions violates their First Amendment rights. Pennsylvania has such a ban. Today on Ballot Talks on Radio Times, the state of Pennsylvania's judiciary, we have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Lynn Marks is the executive director of Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts. She's the co-chair of the Pennsylvania Interbranch Commission for Gender, Racial, and Ethnic Fairness, and she sits on the Pennsylvania Bar Association's House of Delegates. Lynn Marks, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Gina Passarella. She's a reporter for the Legal Intelligencer covering the business of law. Gina, nice to have you back as well.
Thank you.
And rounding out our trio of guests is Peter Hall. He's a reporter for the Morning Call in Allentown covering federal courts and legal affairs. And Peter Hall, welcome to Radio Times.
Great to be here, Marty.
Very, very nice to have you. And Peter, I'm going to go to a piece that you wrote recently that you have to go back to 1704, 311 years ago, to see a vacancy on what, the Commonwealth's highest courts?
That's right. It's the first time since 1704 that we have seen this much turnover among the justices of the state's highest court. What's different about this year is that voters will have the opportunity to select the new justices. In 1704, it was the British Crown who approved the replacement justices.
Well, and of course, a dramatic difference because of the founding of this country. To you, Gina, we're talking about three vacancies, two Supreme Court justices leaving under a cloud, if I can put it that way, and then the retirement of Ron Castile, who was the lead, I guess, justice on the Supreme Court. Castile left because of retirement, yes? Retirement age.
Correct, yes. He reached the mandatory retirement age of 70 and left the bench at the end of last year. And to understand how we get to three vacancies, you have to go back, I think, to 2009 when Joan Ori Melvin, she was elected to the bench. And then ensuing years, she got caught up in allegedly using her judicial staff to help run her campaign for reelection, ended up being convicted, removed from the bench, and an interim justice was put in place, Justice Corey Stevens, to sit for her. His interim position is up at the end of last year, beginning of this year, at the end of 2015. So his spot will be open for an election this year, as will Chief Justice Castile's, and then Justice Seamus McCaffrey retired last year.
Under a cloud?
Yes, that is certainly fair to say. Was being investigated by the Judicial Conduct Board for a number of things, including most recently sending pornographic emails into the state attorney general's office.
Then, Marks, how many states elect their judges or justices?
Well, Pennsylvania is one of only six states that elect all levels of our judges in partisan elections. And that means partisan elections are those where people run on a party line. So we're there with Alabama, Louisiana, Texas, West Virginia, Illinois. Now, some other states do elect some of their judges and some appointed. Some of them have retention elections, but we're only one of six that elect them all, as we do, all the way from the magistrate or district judge all the way up to the Supreme Court.
And you have, if I can say, been fighting this fight for about two decades now, the idea of bringing merit selection into the state of Pennsylvania. How would you like it to work?
Well, currently, as I said, all levels of judges are chosen in party in partisan elections. So that means they need to get endorsements from parties, from the political parties, and from all kinds of special interest groups that might come before them. And they need to raise a lot of money, because how else are you going to get known? Because most judicial candidates are not household names. So in the current system, these candidates basically who are running – this is for the appellate courts – you know, crisscross the state raising enormous sums of money from interest groups and lawyers, pledging – that they're going to be, you know, as good as they can, but it's a very partisan process for a very nonpartisan job. So many organizations, a growing number of organizations, are saying that these partisan elections for the three appellate courts, that's the Supreme, the Superior, and the Commonwealth, should be replaced by a system which centers around what are the merits, what are the qualifications of candidates. And it's often called merit selection. And merit selection is it's a hybrid, basically. It's a point of elective process where their criteria are written right into the Constitution, and a bipartisan citizen nominating committee would evaluate candidates. Give a very short list to the governor, who must select from that list. And then after Senate confirmation, a judge would sit for 4 years and then go before the people in a nonpartisan retention vote to decide whether they should stay on the bench for another 10 years. So it's part appointive, part elective. It's part – this is for the statewide bench. It's not for those on the common pleas and magistrate or district judges. And the states that have it say that they – that is one of the things which is better, is that people don't think that the judges are beholden to those who helped get them elected in the first place, and they get people who were clearly chosen according to their qualifications and not according to whether they're a good fundraiser or a good campaigner.
Let me go back to you, Peter, because you wrote a piece about the sort of efforts to try to bring about some changes in how judges get their jobs in Pennsylvania. And there have been bills in the legislature for some time now, but they don't seem to have a lot of traction.
Well, that's right. It seems almost that there's a perennial effort to introduce legislation, to pass legislation that would make merit selection a reality. But it, as you said, doesn't seem to have much traction. And the challenge is that to establish merit selection, we need to change the state constitution.
Which is not an easy thing to do.
No, the legislation has to be passed in two consecutive sessions and then approved in a referendum by voters.
Why do you think? And I mean, I don't know how many times, Lynn Marks, I've talked to you about your efforts to try to change how we have judges and justices in Pennsylvania. Gina, why do you think there has been resistance based on your understanding of the state?
Perhaps this is a more cynical view of it, but I mean, there's a lot of money that goes into this, and the people who are donating to these judges' campaigns and seeing their candidates get elected are also putting their resources behind ensuring that the system stays as it is.
And how much money? I mean, we know that at least in Pennsylvania, for other offices, there's really unlimited amount of campaign contributions. Is that true for judges as well? You're
it
nodding,
is.
Yes.
It is. And, I mean, we've seen, you know, Justice McCaffrey, who we talked about at his last race back in 2007, he raised more than $2 million to get onto the bench. I mean, we're talking a lot of money. Not all races raise that much, but Supreme Court level, they could.
And who tends, Lynn, to give to these kinds of campaigns?
Well, I want to point out that we're talking here about the money, and Gina mentioned $2 million. But, you know, people think that, you know, they see elections for all branches, for people who are governor and mayor and legislator and council, and you hear millions and millions of dollars. But people have to realize that judges are different from people in the executive and the legislative branch. So unlike mayors and legislators who have platforms and constituencies and take positions on issues, and that's whether we vote for them or not, judges are supposed to make decisions based solely on the facts and the law and not according to what they said on the campaign trail. The money in judicial races is very different. It's more damaging because it's so often it's given by lawyers and interest groups who have business before the courts or the candidates themselves. So, you know, not as many people give to these elections, but the ones that do have business before the court. And that's why there's such a public perception that, you know, justice is for sale. Whether it's right or not, when people are sitting in a courtroom and they look and their opponent made a contribution to the judge or their lawyer made a contribution to the judge, they're going to wonder if they got a fair shake. And so that's why it's real different to think about money in judges' races.
And questions of impartiality. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Gina.
And I think, you know, a lot of people, when we hear the Citizens United case and how a lot of folks talk about corporations contributing to campaigns of all levels, you know, it's the corporate side. In Pennsylvania, particularly on the judicial races, it's really unions and trial lawyers are some of the biggest contributors. So it's a bit of a different perspective on it, I think.
Do judges recuse themselves if people appear before them who have donated to their campaigns? Does anybody know?
They're not. Lynn? I mean, they're not required to unless it's a huge amount, and that's a change in the new code of conduct. But it doesn't say what that huge amount is. But certainly there are cases that say, hey, that's the system. You know, they can contribute. We would hope that they would always put that on the record and disclose it, but, you know, they don't really have to do that. So, again, that's why contributions to judges are so much more dangerous than to the other branches.
Yeah, Peter, it looks like you want to add something. Go ahead.
Well, my thought was that it has become an issue in past elections. In 2009, we saw Judge Jack Pinella, who was running for the Supreme Court, facing criticism in a request to have the Supreme Court review one of his decisions because he had ruled in favor of a medical malpractice plaintiff whose lawyer had contributed to his campaign, not a great deal of money, I think, on the order of several thousand, but had also literally placed the robes around his shoulders when he was elevated to the Superior Court. And they claimed that that was reason enough that he should have recused himself from hearing that case.
But that's one case.
That's one case that comes to mind.
Yeah, Gina.
It came up in Justice McCaffrey's situation on a slightly different level. And one of the things that he was under fire for was that his wife, his chief aide and a lawyer in his chambers, was collecting referral fees from firms who had gone before the court. Now, not necessarily in cases that the wife accepted money in. Justice McCaffrey's point was, I did disclose this on my annual financial disclosure form showing which entities paid myself or my spouse money, but he didn't disclose it on the bench before the attorneys, before he heard the case. And there's a question about whether that was appropriate or not. I believe under the ethics rules, at the time at least, it was acceptable.
Hold on to that thought only because we have to take a very short break. That's Gina Passarella. She's a reporter for the Legal Intelligencer. Also with us, Peter Hall, reporter for the Morning Call in Allentown. And Lynn Marks, executive director of Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts. It's Ballot Talks on Radio Times. We are talking about the state of Pennsylvania's judiciary. We've got calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Peter Hall, Gina Passarella, and Lynn Marks. We are talking about Pennsylvania's judiciary, or the state of the state's judiciary. Looks like we got a lot of callers coming in, and I'm seeing a tweet from Daniel. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and also check us out on Facebook. And there will be judicial elections later this year. We want to know how you decide, or if you decide, or how you struggle to decide who you want to vote for to sit on the bench here in the Commonwealth. Let me just toss out a name here, and this is Chief Justice Thomas Saylor. He has, I guess, taken over from Ron Castile. Gina, I'm looking at you. What do we need to know about him?
So The Legal wrote an article about Justice Saylor a few years ago in which we called him the loneliest justice because
– The loneliest.
Yes, because he is prone to write dissents or concurring opinions more so than his fellow justices just to express, you know, maybe a slightly different view from the majority. And we wrote that article. He said to us, you know, he didn't find an issue with it. But the funny thing about him being the loneliest justice is everybody who talks about how he will be an administrator as the chief of the court considers him a consensus builder, much more so than his predecessor, Ron Castile. He even said in that article a few years ago, it's pretty difficult to decide what's in the exclusive purview of the Supreme Court. And I think he was talking more about cases and how they decide them. But I think as an administrator, he's not one to say, this is ours to decide or this is mine to decide. He's going to really try to get the buy-in from his fellow justices and only on issues that he thinks is appropriate for the court to be handling.
Peter, let me go back to you. This is a little bit of ancient history, but it seems that the relationship between then Chief Justice Ron Castile and then Justice Seamus McCaffrey, I don't know. I don't exactly know what the word is, but it seemed intensely negative, intensely personal. At one point, Justice Castile called McCaffrey a sociopath.
Yeah, I think it would be fair to say it was strained, and I'm not sure that anyone really understands the full depth of that relationship dynamic. I recently interviewed former Chief Justice Castile, and we talked about that a bit. And he was complimentary of Chief Justice, or rather Justice McCaffrey in the beginning, said he had a lot of faith in him, put him in charge of administrative duties in the Philadelphia courts. But he said that over the years, as the gaffes and the questionable conduct mounted in regard to an involvement in the traffic court scandal, his wife taking referral fees, he came to be of the opinion that he was not suitable to be on the Supreme Court.
To you, Lynn, I mean, just picking up on that, and also the fact that we've got two justices on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court who left under a cloud, it does raise questions about just how functional, how effective this court is and can be.
Well, you mentioned the election before, and we talk about it being unprecedented that there are going to be three openings. People might not know that there are only seven people on the court. So that's three out of seven, which is really going to be a sea change in terms of the court's jurisprudence and how it functions. But, you know, it's really disheartening for we, the public, to see this kind of behavior, the name calling, the pornographic emails, the turmoil on the court. You know, every justice should be working to reassure Pennsylvanians that they can come to court and be heard by qualified, fair, and impartial judges. And, you know, just the appearance of impropriety or misbehavior can be devastating to people's confidence in the judiciary, even if no legal wrongdoing occurred. And that's one of the things which we're really concerned at Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts, that people feel like they're getting a fair shake, mm-hmm. that their cases at all levels are heard by qualified judges who have good judgment. You know, and good judgment probably does not include sending pornographic emails or name-calling in the press.
Certainly not using the office computer to
right,
do that,
right, and all that thing. And I think that it's fair because judges sit in judgment of others. I think it's really fair to hold them to a higher standard. And there are judicial ethics, and it's very important that there is a code of judicial conduct. But I think the fact that there is going to be such transition in the Supreme Court will probably be a good thing in terms of the tarnished image that it's had. And I know that the new Chief Justice, Justice Saylor, as well as the other justices on the court, are going to work very hard to get to the next stage and to have the Supreme Court in the news only when it issues decisions. And then that becomes the story, is the decisions, particularly the high-profile decisions, which impact so many people. They should be in the in the news when there's maybe a new drug court or a new mental health court, or there are issues around funding. But they shouldn't be in the news when it comes to the personalities of the judges themselves.
Well, I was thinking about traffic court here in Philadelphia, Gina. I sort of led with that in my introduction and sort of this laundry list of court issues. But, that's a pretty dramatic change in Philadelphia.
It is. And the traffic court was nearly the entire court in Philadelphia was indicted on charges of essentially giving preferential treatment to those who were connected to the court, friends of the court, politicians, the like. And some of them pled guilty. Others went to trial. They were not found guilty of having technically fixed tickets, but a few of them were found guilty of perjury and related charges. And the federal judge who sentenced them, their sentences have been happening over the last few months. I mean, he's been giving out, you know, sentences in the range of upward of 2 years and has said in court, you know, that you can't tell me there wasn't ticket fixing here. So I think he's doling out punishments that he thinks, reflect what he viewed as a systemic problem in that court that now no longer exists as a result.
Go ahead, Lynn.
I just want to mention a thing about the traffic court, and that is because we get calls all the time or, you know, talk to people, and people say, well, so what? It's only traffic court. You know, what do you expect? But, you know, traffic court and the other lower courts are often called the people's courts, and those are the part of the court system where most people come into contact. So I think they even have a bigger responsibility to the public to be seen as, you know, as above board and operating at the highest level of ethics so that people can trust in the system. And so right. It's not right to poo-poo that and say, that's only, you know, the lower courts.
You're more likely to get a traffic ticket than you are to appear before a judge or a court on another issue. Did you want to add something? Oh, no. Okay. That's okay. We have let me get a couple of callers in, and then I do want to talk with you, Peter, about Kathleen Kane, who is in the news once again. But let me see first what Ron from Drescher has to say. Ron, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, Ron.
I'm a retired social studies teacher, but I want to present a hypothetical. My students, of course, understood what representative democracy was, and I'm looking for an explanation in defense of the current system of electing judges in Pennsylvania, especially the top court positions. I'm wondering what any of your guests would say to one of my students about why are we overlooking representative democracy and just having these direct elections when so much of our system, of course, is based on having representatives making decisions.
So, I think what you're saying is we elect other members of branches of government. Why can't we continue to elect members of the judiciary? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And the history and thought behind this concept.
All right. Well, I mean, I don't think you're here to defend the system as it is, Lynn Marks, but we do have a history, certainly, in this state of electing judges. And there is an argument, I guess, that if it's good enough for a governor, why isn't it good enough for a judge?
Yeah, Ron, I think that's an interesting question. In Pennsylvania, we've elected judges since 1850. Before that, they were appointed. They're appointed at the federal level. They're appointed in many, many other states. I think the argument for electing them is, we elect all of our public officials. Why don't we also elect, we can elect judges. It doesn't matter that, there's always a very low turnout or that people don't know much about them. We would elect them. But the argument on the other side is kind of what I said earlier, is to always remember that the role of a judge is so different from the role of somebody in the executive or legislative branch, which are there to represent. You mentioned representative democracy. They are there to represent the will of the people, the will of their constituents, the majority rule. Judges are not there to represent people. They're not there to represent the majority view. They're there to uphold the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And so the argument for not electing judges is because their role is so different, they shouldn't be beholden to the public. And because the role is so different, it makes sense to choose them differently.
Thanks for the call, Ron. And I mean, on the one hand, that seems like what Lynn Marks just said seems like a very cogent argument. And yet, as you both have said, the system remains as it is in Pennsylvania.
It does. And I think part of the argument as to why we should keep electing judges is because, oh, there are problems with every system. You know, the appointed process, you know, then you have to be political, too, to get on the committee's radar screen or to have the governor pick you from the list. But Lynn brings, as you said, raises some excellent points as to why the judiciary is very different from other offices.
And that's Gina Passarella, reporter for the Legal Intelligencer, Lynn Marks, executive director of Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts, and Peter Hall. He covers the courts and legal affairs for the Morning Call in Allentown. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. We have a bunch of emails. You can do that as well, radiotimes@whyy.org. And send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Peter, we've done whole hours on the Attorney General Kathleen Kane, but if you can just get us up to speed, I guess, on what happened yesterday.
Sure. Well, the latest development is that the State Supreme Court unsealed a number of documents that, for the first time, confirm that a grand jury has recommended charges against the Attorney General. She has not been charged. That decision will be up to the Montgomery County District Attorney. But it sheds light on what this grand jury that we've known about for several months now has been doing. We saw Kathleen Kane appear before the grand jury. She testified, I believe, in November. And we knew from reports in the Philadelphia Inquirer and other publications that it was centered on a leak of material regarding an investigation back in 2009 that was shelved into a Philadelphia civil rights leader.
Jerry Mondesire. Former head
correct.
Of the local NAACP.
Right. And that information appeared in the Philadelphia Daily News back in June. the question is, how did that information get to the newspaper, and did Kathleen Kane have a role in leaking it?
You're not supposed to leak grand jury information.
That's right. Grand jury proceedings are supposed to be entirely secret.
She has said, though, and then we'll go back to our callers, is that she doesn't think the Supreme Court had the legal authority to, I guess, call an investigation of her
right.
That's alleged activities.
Also, the other development yesterday was that the state Supreme Court has agreed to hear her challenge to the appointment of a special prosecutor to look into this matter, and that will be briefed and argued at the Supreme Court's March session.
Anything? Yeah, go ahead, Gina.
The one other interesting thing there is that it was former Chief Justice Castile who signed off on the appointment of that special prosecutor.
One of the things that the documents revealed yesterday was that the supervising judge took it upon himself to appoint the special prosecutor. He wrote a letter to the Chief Justice saying, please let me know if I've overstepped my bounds. And as far as we know, I mean, we haven't seen anything from the former Chief Justice either way on that.
And that would be former Chief Justice Ron Castile.
Correct.
Just to sort of
yes.
Connect more of the dots here. Let me get to, looks like an anonymous caller from Philadelphia. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Yes, hi. I thank you very much for covering this topic.
Sure.
It's one that's been very interesting and sort of disheartening at the same time for me for a long time. I was a prosecutor for many years in Philadelphia. And, you know, when I first started, I was gung-ho and young and naive. And along the way, I saw many situations that indicated to me that it's a problem that our judges on common pleas are elected. In one situation, I actually saw a letter from a judge that had just been elected onto the bench to the private defense bar, the members of the private defense bar, not the public defenders, asking them to donate additional funds because he had incurred quite a bit of expense trying to get onto the common pleas court. And he owed some money on loans that he had taken out to be able to carry out his campaign. And the letters went out to almost everyone that was in opposition in the courtroom to the prosecutors, the private defense bar. And they themselves were flabbergasted obviously having been put in a situation in which they felt that if they didn't contribute to this newly elected judge and had to appear before him with a case, that their cases might go, you know, not their way because they had not contributed enough
sure.
money to this one judge.
Yeah, let me take your point and actually give it to our guest, Lynn Marks. In Pennsylvania, as it stands now, can judges directly solicit, as our anonymous caller described?
Well, I also heard of the situation which the caller has mentioned. In Pennsylvania, as in many other states, there is actually a ban on judicial candidates or judges directly soliciting campaign contributions. So, you know, so you, Marty, Judge Moskowain, can't call one of you up and say, I'd like money for my campaign. I know you appear before me all the time, but I need money. Please give it to me. So they're not allowed to do that. But their campaign committee can do that. They can say, you know, I've been asked to raise money. I'm raising money for Judge Moskowain. You know, please give. Mm. So it's important to have that buffer in so that the judge, him or herself, or the judicial candidate, him or herself, can't do it. But the reality is money is going to be raised. I mean, that's the system we have. We elect judges in political elections, and money drives the election to get known. It's really quite timely because just earlier this week, a case was argued before the United States Supreme Court involving a Florida law, just like the one I announced in terms of this ban. And that law is being challenged as violating the First Amendment rights of judges and judicial candidates. But it has real implications for Pennsylvania.
And I do
well.
Want to pick up on that only because we have to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking on Ballot Talks on Radio Times today about the Pennsylvania judiciary. That's Lynn Marks, Executive Director of Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts. Gina Passarella is a reporter for the Legal Intelligencer, and Peter Hall covers the courts and legal affairs for the Morning Call in Allentown. We're taking your calls at 1-888-477-9499. Also, I do want to read some emails, radiotimes at whyy.org, and some tweets at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Again, I'm talking with Lynn Marks, Peter Hall, and Gina Passarella. And we've been discussing the fact that there are three openings on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and there are elections this year. We're talking about some of the fallout of the Porngate scandal that led to the retirement of former Supreme Court Justice Seamus McCaffrey. Talking a bit about the Attorney General and some of her allegations and problems, if we can put it that way. And taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I do want to pick up on a case that was argued before the U.S. Supreme Court earlier this week. I don't know, Gina, if you have looked at that or not, but I know, Lynn Marks, your organization had a friend of the court opinion that and basically saying, and I'm going to quote here, permitting judicial candidates, some of whom are sitting judges, to directly ask lawyers and litigants for money is just wrong. It puts lawyers in a catch-22 position about whether to contribute, and it's uncomfortable for candidates, particularly those who are already judges. Personal solicitation tarnishes people's confidence in the judiciary, and the court is looking at whether a ban on asking for money is a violation of a judge's or a candidate's First Amendment rights.
That's correct, Marty. And I think that most people don't even know that judicial candidates and judges can't personally ask for campaign contributors because they have a committee that can do that all the time, and the judge can be standing right there, but the judge is not supposed to directly ask. So it might seem like a minor thing, but the reason we don't think it's minor is because if we're going to continue to elect judges to the extent we can, we should have rules that make them at least appear in reality and the appearance in being impartial. And not to put lawyers in a very uncomfortable position, lawyers and people who might appear before the court. But also, it's not comfortable for the judges to have to be in that position, you know, to be asking for money. But as I said before, money in judicial elections is so important to get known and to run a campaign. And that's who the judges are most familiar with. They're people in the legal community. So it really is a catch-22.
Indeed. Indeed. Anything either of you want to add to that, Gina, or you, Peter?
I think slightly different topic, but there's a culture among judges that the issue of recusing is kind of, you know, they don't want to have to recuse. I only have to do that when there's an appearance of impartiality, and I know I can be fair in this case. It doesn't matter what money I took or what connections I have. So it's tough because so I think that's why those rules do make sense. Let's distance themselves as much as we can from that, knowing that in the courtroom there's a hesitancy to step back from a case.
And Peter, one wonders whether it's, you know, a scandal that would change the system, or whether there's a kind of, you know, outpouring of voters who say, I've had enough. I just don't want to vote for judicial candidates anymore. I mean, and as you said, it's a high bar to change the state constitution.
Yeah. The McCaffrey situation?
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't really have a good gauge of how voters have responded to that. I think there has to be a weariness, a skepticism that's developed in the last several years. As you said, we've gone from cash for kids. We've seen one justice convicted, another resign under a cloud. There have been a handful of the traffic court and a handful of one-off removals of magisterial district judges around the state. It all builds up to a question in voters' minds of who are we putting on the courts. But in my interview with Chief Justice Castile, I mentioned earlier, he told me that he has a lot of confidence in the judiciary, that there are around 1,000 elected judges in Pennsylvania, and we've only seen a few instances, and the system has responded to it. The state's response to the Cash for Kids scandal, for example, was to put together an interbranch commission that looked at what changes were necessary to prevent that kind of thing from happening in the future, and then erasing the records of every juvenile who had appeared before those two judges.
But this was after the Juvenile Law Center in Philadelphia.
Yes.
I mean, really took the case and challenged and investigated what was going on there. It seems like it took time to
do
that.
It did, and it's a shame that it took so long for that to come to light.
Indeed.
And it took the involvement of a number of groups and agencies.
I think, Pete, what you were saying about former Chief Justice Castile's thoughts about the court, they're shared by Chief Justice Saylor, who told The Legal, you know, a lot of the problems for the Supreme Court were issues created by a few big personalities who, frankly, are no longer on the court. And he said the integrity of the institution, which is the most important thing, is still intact. And the way we restore the faith of the community in us is by continuing to do our good work. Now, there are people in the legal community and beyond who think, hey, you know, why should Justice McCaffrey get to retire and settle out essentially his Judicial Conduct Board investigation and keep his pension? Maybe that investigation should continue on, even if he's not on the bench. So there are certainly mixed views about it, I think.
Lynn. You know, even though I know that former Chief Justice Castile talked a lot about having faith in the institution, he also spoke, as did a number of the judges, really have talked about how the reputation of the court has really been tarnished recently, and they're very, very concerned about that, as they should be. And Justice Castile talked a lot about how bad it is for the court's image that to get to the to get to become a Supreme Court justice, they have to raise millions of dollars. I mean, he's very clear about that, as of chief justices and other statesmen, that they're very concerned about what is the public's perception of them, and that, you know, you look at the public polling in Pennsylvania and across the country, and, you know, you see 75, 80, 85% of people polled saying that they think that judges make decisions according to campaign contributions. I mean, that is really staggering. And I'm not saying that they do that, but the fact that the people believe that is very discouraging. And listen, I'm the first to say that there's no perfect system of choosing judges. I mean, there's no system that's going to get politics out of the system. But certainly getting away from partisan elections gets the money out of the system. And that's really a big part of what people's concerns are. And it puts the element of qualifications, because everybody agrees that the current system, even though we do get plenty of qualified candidates, it's not based on qualifications. It's based on, you know, who can win. And too often that means special interest endorsements and money.
Yeah. Did you want to add something, Peter?
Well, Gina raised a point that I'd kind of be interested to hear Lynn's thoughts on, that all of the problems, or most of the problems on the court over the last several years have been the result of a few big personalities. And I wonder whether the elective process, whether you feel that the elective process attracts or results in those big personalities getting onto the court, rather than the scholarly types who might better serve.
Yeah. Well, those are good questions, and I think it's part of each. I mean, but I don't think we can just say, oh, there are a few big personalities, and once they're off the court, everything's going to be fine. I mean, there are some institutional problems there, and the reality of electing judges was you end up getting people who were very good campaigners, they're good fundraisers, they have they're more known to the public, they have some kind of constituency. They will have a leg up on those who might not even put their name in. There are so many good lawyers in this state who would be great judges, but they're not even going to put their name in because they don't think that they'll have a chance of winning. They don't have the political context. They don't have the money. In the last Supreme Court race, there was only one Democrat who ran. I mean, you got to tell me there are more than one Democratic person who would win across the state, but people just didn't put their name in. So you get a different pool of candidates, but again, we're not as concerned about those the individuals. It's the system. We want a system which is based on qualifications and not where judges are chosen by whether they have a good ballot position or whether they come from a county where there was a big turnout this year, or whether they have a familiar name, that kind of thing, or, you know, 2 second sound bites.
Well, and I do want to get back to our callers. And, Gina, I don't know how many people have said to me, you know, that they'll go to the polls to vote and they see these names. They know nothing about them. They don't know who they are voting for.
Particularly at the primary level. I mean, there's upwards of almost 20 people that have thrown their name in the ring for the Supreme Court races. So you're going to pick three on the R's and three on the D side, and there's going to be this list of names. And depending on what ballot spot they get, that's a big factor in who gets elected in these judicial races, particularly at the county levels. And the bar associations do a bit of vetting, recommended, not recommended, you know, and how much they can say and how much the judicial candidates can say about themselves, right. And their philosophy is limited, and rightfully so, but it makes it hard to know who you're voting for.
Let me see what Bob from Center City has to say. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. Good morning, everyone. Morning. We have a minor judiciary in the state known as the magistrate court system. There's over 550 of them. None of them have to be lawyers, and they're elected. All you have to do is be 18 years old and be elected. Now, I have had experience with them, and the problem with them is a lot of their court cases are held in secret. They actually close the door, hold a trial one by one with the private people in the room, whether it's a criminal or small claims case. And Article 1, Section 11 of the Pennsylvania Constitution says that all courts shall be open. Uh-huh. And they're violating that left and right. I'd say numerous ones are. Now, talking about Article 1, Section 11, vis-a-vis the traffic court, which is now the Municipal Court Traffic Division, they now have five people who are at-will hearing examiners that are beholden to their employer, holding private hearings in private conference rooms there now. So that problem has not been solved. And the other problem with the traffic court is the traffic court was and is a constitutional court. And one of your guests had said there's one way to amend the Pennsylvania Constitution, and that's by having two consecutive votes in a session by the Congress of the House and Senate of Pennsylvania in two consecutive sessions, which amounts to 2 years and 2 years, 4 years,
sure.
And then a vote by the electorate. That never has happened. And now you have a
Well, you know what, Bob? Only because you've put about three or four things on the table, and I want to actually pick up on the first thing that you said, actually to put this to you, Peter, about these magistrate courts that he talked about and feeling as if they are, in a sense, closed courts and whether that's a kind of a violation.
Well, my understanding is that that should not be happening. I think there are a few limited circumstances under which court proceedings can be closed in Pennsylvania, but a magistrate court is like any other court. Whether it's the magistrate court is often in a strip mall or some building somewhere, but it's the same as
it's open.
The court in City Hall or your county courthouse. It needs to be open.
Yeah, Gina,
I would agree with Pete and Bob. I'm really glad that you mentioned that. These judges don't have to be attorneys, and I think that we've seen over the last couple of years, whether it be just what the focus of the Judicial Conduct Board is or for some other reason, there are a number of magisterial district judges getting in trouble, getting removed from the bench or suspended, and I think that may point to an issue with that system.
I'm going to read a bunch of a tweet and three emails. This is for you, Lynn Marks. A tweet from Daniel: the system is broken, but merit selection is still partisan. See Bush v. Gore. An email from Peter: your panelists are right in pointing out the pluses of merit selection. A concern is that the panels tend to produce candidates who come from large corporate-dominated firms. An email from Beverly: in addition to the merit selection your guests described, Delaware requires a balance between Republicans and Democrats on all courts. An email from Art: first, I want to say that I agree that the current system is broken, but I don't think merit selection is the answer. Politics are inescapable. Appointments are just political selection with a smaller electorate. I know you've heard all those arguments against merit selection.
I'm really glad that we brought all those out, and I'm sorry we're not going to have more time to respond to them. And I said before, there's certainly no perfect way of choosing judges. And hey, look, we know there's still going to be politics in a merit selection system. I mean, there are politics in everything. There are politics in family dynamics and office politics and so forth. But one of the current system of electing judges is a totally political system, capital P. With a merit selection system, and one thing that's, we think, much better than the federal system, somebody mentioned Bush v. Gore, is in the federal system, the governor can appoint anybody who he or hopefully someday she wants. In a merit selection system, it's basically it's a hybrid between – it takes part of what we have here in Pennsylvania of electing judges and part of what the federal system does in appointing judges, but that there would be a bipartisan citizen panel – which would be appointed by a lot of different people so that nobody can control that panel. And they look over qualifications and recommend to the governor. The governor can't just select whoever the governor wants. So there are a lot of checks and balances in there. And the important part is anybody can put their name in. I mean, anybody. They would be their qualifications written right into the Constitution. Now the only qualification is to become a judge or a lawyer, being 18 and a resident for a year. And so, you know, I mentioned before that, you know, nobody in the last Supreme Court race, you know, on the Democratic side, there was only one candidate. This way you could have a lot of people putting in their name. So, you know, I understand some of the comments that people have, but I think there's been a lot of thought in terms of the politics and trying to get the politics and particularly the money out of the system.
Well, we have to end on that note. They're playing my song. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Lynn Marks, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Executive Director of Pennsylvanians for Modern Courts, Gina Passarella, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. She's a reporter for the Legal Intelligencer. And Peter Hall, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. A reporter for the Morning Call in Allentown. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. And it looks like we already have a pretty interesting conversation probably taking place on our Facebook page. Go and check it out and weigh in as well. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.